Just how much there is to know about the world that is unknown, that is unexplored. The Nabataeans. Most people don't really hardly know anything about it. They may not even have heard that term, Nabatea, before. It's incredibly fascinating. I don't care what the subject is. If you look deep enough and talk to somebody that really knows about it, there is really fascinating stuff to be found there. Then on top of that, you find out the deeper you look into something, the more you know how much people don't know.
Welcome to Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff, where we interview newsmakers, storytellers, and all-around interesting people. Sit back, relax, unless you're driving, and enjoy the show. Here's Jackson.
Hello, hello, hello. I am Jackson Huff. This is Not in a Huff. Thanks so much for joining me. As always, really appreciate it. This week, I'm speaking with Brock Meyer. Now, I've got to tell you, 6 months ago, every few years, I am put on this email list to have different podcast guests. Some of them you've already listened to have been part of that. Others are coming up. A ton to get through. You know, I booked it 6 months ago, and man, I'm still interviewing people, so always a great thing. But you know, I put out kind of a call for people, interesting people to come on. Brock is one of those people. I tell you all that because he presented himself kind of in his submission as the most interesting man in the world. And of course, that kind of perks up your ears. He's not from the Dos Equis commercials. Sorry to burst that bubble, but what he is somebody who has done a lot of really cool stuff. He's been a winemaker. He's been a scientist. He's been somebody who searched and studied a lot about an ancient civilization called Nabatea. That's what we're going to talk quite a bit about. I had someone on about a year ago that talked all about Atlantis and where Atlantis would be now and, you know, middle of Africa and how it was probably an advanced civilization, all this kind of stuff. But people don't truly know. People aren't all on the same page about that. But most people are on the same page about Nabatea. It was a group of people that at one point were really, really big. They are the ones that are responsible for Petra in Jordan. If you know anything about that, you know, the big homes and city built into rocks, definitely an amazing thing that is just a shell of its former self at this point, but still an absolutely magnificent thing. He's going to talk about, you know, these people and why we don't know a ton about them. It's kind of an interesting reason. You know, they were some of the, probably the, one of the more advanced groups back in their time. I think they were kind of competing with Rome and all that kind of stuff too. He's going to talk a little bit about that, but why are a civilization that expanded and got big and was something that was powerful in its time, do we know nothing about? I assume most of you are going to say Nabatea, never heard of it. And the reason for that is a pretty unique one. He's going to kind of talk about that. We're going to talk a lot about just his life as an interesting guy. You know, I hate to always say the word interesting, but he literally said one of the most interesting men in the world. I think he's been dubbed that by a friend and his daughter. So it's not a self-description. But yeah, I found him really, really awesome. You know, he's written books to make it, you know, this world Nabatea more digestible because there it's, you know, books in the fiction world, kind of following a person in that world and learning a lot about, you know, about the civilization along the way. Yeah, I think you're really going to enjoy this one. You know, at the end, I'll give you all the ways to connect with him and get the book. I've got to say, you know, here, please do follow along with the podcast on Instagram, Not Enough Podcast, TikTok, Not Enough Podcast, JacksonHuff.com, Not Enough with Jackson Huff on Facebook. Leave that 5-star rating on Apple and on Spotify. That helps a lot. But without further ado, here is Brock Meyer. Mr. Meyer, how are you?
I'm great. Glad to be a part of the conversation today.
Well, glad to have you. I'm going to let you do the heavy lifting right off the bat and just introduce yourself.
Okay. I'm Brock Meyer. I am currently an historical fiction author. I launched my debut novel, I guess that was towards the end of September of last year. Right. Previous to that, for 50 years, I was involved in research science and engineering.
Yeah, and that's exactly where I want to begin too. So I want to kind of talk about life before becoming an author. You were in scientific research. What was that exactly? What's that mean?
After I graduated from college, and my degree is actually in metallurgical engineering, but pretty rapidly I entered a research laboratory that was one of the premier institutions for producing infrared detector arrays. And a lot of people wouldn't really know what that is, except it's really pretty simple. It's much like the retina part of a digital camera, which produces images of visible light. But instead, in a thermal camera, it produces images from infrared light. So you can look at a scene, look at whatever it is, and detect fine differences of temperature, as well as seeing the spatial organization of the scene. So it's used in military, in astronomy, medical facilities use it. It's used in all sorts of places. Started there. I eventually ended up working for a company the last 25 years, which had contracts with the United States Air Force Research Laboratory. And our part of it was looking at not only the advancement of laser technology, but also, maybe even more importantly, how does laser exposure interact with human vision and human tissue? So that's what I've been doing basically for the last 50 years, things of that sort. So I've been in and out of laboratories. I've got a collection of six different lab coats from the different organizations that I worked for over the years. So that led me to the point of being an author.
So were you ever kind of doing both and moonlighting as an author, or did you start kind of writing once maybe you retired, or what's that look like?
I have kind of an atypical history of becoming an author. If you read a lot of bios of authors, they often say something like, "When I picked up my first crayon at age three, I knew I was going to be an author someday." Well, that wasn't me. I really had no interest in writing a novel at all. And I did fool around with writing blog articles of things that were of interest to me, oh, probably starting 6 or 7 years ago. And that was interesting. I would write about, at the time, I was a fine art photographer as well as my day job of research. And connected with that, I had a blog that I talked about photography and art in general, things of that sort. Whatever struck my fancy at one point in time, I just write about that. And then this was probably 6 years ago. I thought, I'm writing these articles, and I think I'm a pretty good author because for years and years I'd written technical reports as an engineer and a scientist, but that's pretty dry, not really meant for pleasurable reading. So I thought, there's a local critique group, writers group, and maybe I'll connect with them and see if I can brush up in my on my creative writing skills and see what goes. So I was with them for a few to maybe several years, and most of the people in there were pretty heavily invested in writing books, either memoirs or novels for the most part. Some had already published and some were on the verge of publishing. And there was a guy about my age. I was going to say an older gentleman, but guess what? I'm an older gentleman too. Anyway, I was really struck by the novel that he'd written. And we were in the final stages of going through some of his last chapters. So after one of the meetings one time, I stopped him in the hall and I said, "Henry, how long did it take you to write this novel?" He stopped and thought about it for a while and said, "Well, I think that was about 10 years." And I thought to myself, well, I'm never going to write a novel if it takes 10 years. Mm. So that was kind of the end of that. But in kind of a strange way, I was unexpectedly dragged into writing a novel.
I love it. And I'm glad that it didn't take you 10 years, but I want to kind of, before we get into the nitty gritty about your writing, the thing that kind of, I guess, drew me to you, because, you know, we conversed over, you know, me reaching out for people who wanted to be on the podcast. And right. I believe it was your daughter, maybe somebody else, but somebody had coined you the most interesting man in the world. And I know you're not the Dos Equis guy, so we've got to kind of touch on that. I know that, you know, some of the things that you've done is spelunking. You make exotic wine. You just talked about being a fine art photographer. So you've already got a lot on your plate there. But what, I guess that's a huge thing to be called. So to talk about that.
Well, that goes back to, I guess that was last year. I had taken a course in, it was called the Book Launch Blueprint. And it was, it's been done for several years by a guy named Thomas Umstadt, who lives just north of here in Austin. And he is like a national resource for self-published authors and indie authors. And I'd followed his publishing blogs and podcasts for probably a couple of years. And he just really seemed to know what he was talking about and all. Anyway, he has a once a year class that he trains new authors how to launch a book in the best way, because that's a really critical part of an author entering the field. So it was kind of a steep price for me. You know, here I am, an author that hasn't even sold a book yet, and I'm thinking about expending a bunch more money. But my wife had talked me into it, so I thought, okay. And it was really an intensive course. It took about a month, and it was about anywhere between 4 and 8 hours a day of watching videos and also live, he called it office hours time with him, to where you could ask whatever questions you wanted, and homework as well. So that's a pretty considerable amount of effort for an author to get involved in how to launch a book. But one of the exercises had to do with an author branding themselves. And one of the parts of that was to ask all of your friends and all of your relatives who they think you are to describe you in just a very few words. Well, one of my close friends over the years described me as, and he'd told me this even before that, he said, "I think you are the most interesting man in the world." And the other one came from my daughter, who described me as delightfully weird. And I took that one to heart. I thought that was quite a compliment.
I like it. I do like it. I think that's awesome. And you just kind of mentioned your wife. Speaking of interesting things to do, I believe that you got married during COVID times to somebody that you didn't know very long. Talk about that.
Yeah. This was a few years back, several years back now. I found myself unexpectedly single after a 40-year marriage. And it took me quite a while to get used to living just totally on my own. And after a year, year and a half, maybe close to 2 years, I started getting into the swing of it, and I really enjoyed the freedom. But also, back in the back of my mind, there's always this nagging thing of, I really enjoy living my life with a woman, with a partner in life. So I finally thought, well, how am I going to go about doing this? You know, I'm a 73-year-old guy now. I was 70 at the time. And I talked to a close friend of mine, and he said, "Well, you know, I actually met my wife online." I said, "Really?" So he told me the story about that. And I thought, well, you know, maybe I will just stick my neck out and go online and join a dating service, which I did. And they sent me, probably 2 or 3 times a week, some photographs and brief profiles of women and all that, that they thought would match my profile or what I was looking for. And finally, I came across somebody that I thought, you know, I really want to contact this woman and ask her a little bit more about who she is and tell her who I am. Well, I tell you, from the moment we connected online through the dating service, and there the app just expected you to give brief little off-the-cuff questions or remarks that are really small talk. But I tell you, within short order, we were sending each other extended messages through that, then graduated to email. And I think it was by the end of the first week, we never even talked on the phone at that point in time. We had exchanged something like 3,000 or 4,000 words just by text. And pretty rapidly, this is like a woman I've known all my life. So then we graduated to telephone calls, which pretty quickly became 2 and 3 hour conversations by phone. And I think we met at the end of 2 weeks. And then on a trip, she had to deliver some things. We both lived roughly in the San Antonio area. She had to deliver some items to Houston, a few hours away. I said, well, hey, do you mind if I tag along? She said, no, that'd be great. So anyway, on our halfway to the way to Houston, this is 3 weeks after we first made contact online, I looked over at her and I said, will you marry me? And she looked over at me and said, yes. And we married about 6 months later. It was COVID, so it was a pretty low-key event, but it's been just an incredible experience since then. We've been married now 3.5 years.
I love it. I love that story. That story could be like, oh man, it didn't actually work out, and I'm an unexpectedly single again.
I tell you, this is kind of an unusual thing too. A close friend of mine, the wife of the man who called me the most interesting man in the world, his wife said to me when I was thinking about looking for a woman in my life, she said, you know what I did to find my husband? Is that I sat down and I wrote a list of about 20 things that I'd like to find in a man. So I think you ought to do that. So I thought, well, I don't know, maybe I'll do that. And I did sit down and I didn't write 20 things. I wrote maybe half a dozen different things. But let me tell you, that does not at all describe the woman I married. The woman I married is so much better than if I would have found my perfect description of a woman. It boggles my mind that it happened that way, but it did. She is far better than I ever could have made up or dreamed.
Well, I love it. And I'm sure she would love to hear that too. So I think that's really, really awesome for sure.
I tell her all the time.
Good. I want to get back to your writing, and I want to ask, there must be something in the water and, you know, in the Texas Hill Country, because I, you know, I've interviewed quite a few people, but I've actually interviewed an author, a pretty well-known author from that area. And, you know, I was talking to him about it. There's a lot of authors in that area. I don't know, there's something in the water that scenery inspires you, or what makes there be so many authors from Texas Hill Country?
Hard to say. I don't know. It really is a beautiful area. Before I lived here and I didn't know anything about it, you know, I thought Texas, well, what could that be? A bunch of sand and sagebrush. But the state is so large. There are really something of alpine-like mountains in the far west. You know, they don't start from as high a elevation as, let's say, the Rockies in Colorado, but there you're already starting at 5,000 or 6,000 feet. But here you're starting not much more than sea level. So they may not be up there in elevation, but they're still pretty tall mountains. Mm-hmm. There is the hill country where I live, which I think I describe it in my bio as, what did I say? A place of clear spring-fed streams, and treed with ancient cypress, and it has a quiet sort of beauty. And it really does. It's not a spectacular place by any stretch of the imagination, but there's something about it that is really a simple and quiet beauty.
Yeah. No, I've been in that area before. I've made the journey from Austin to San Antonio, and you know, the area that I guess is very German inspired, which I think surprises some people. Really, yeah, no, I like that area for sure. I want to now we've kind of zigzagged our way through your story, but I want to actually get to your book. And to get to that, I guess we're going to take one more zag to the side, because you write about Nebatia, which I want you just to tell us exactly what that is. And I guess what fascinated you so much to write a book about it.
Okay, Nabatea is, if you think about the first century, the time of the heights of the Roman Empire, the time of Jesus, who lived in Judea, which was at the very eastern edge of the Mediterranean Sea. Nabatea was at its height at exactly the same time. And Nabatea was, if you think of Judea being basically the same footprint as the nation of Israel today. So Israel is at the very eastern edge of the Mediterranean, right east of the Jordan River, which forms the eastern border of Israel and Judea. Right east of there was the kingdom of Nabatea. And to kind of relate to you what it looks like and the size of it, Nabatea was just about the roughly the same size and shape of the state of Texas, which was kind of interesting to me. I didn't really notice that until I started looking at the map one day, and I thought, it looks kind of familiar. And I checked it out size-wise, and it's pretty much the same size as well. So if you think of something like Texas, right east of Judea, that's where it existed. It existed for about, I'd say 300 to 400 years, and its peak was right in the first century. I didn't know anything about Nabatea, except for Petra. I'd heard of Petra. Petra was the capital of Nabatea. Petra, as far as I was concerned, was that place that was that famous scene in Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, where they ride into Petra, and that's all you see, and then they go inside, which is nothing like the inside of that building that actually exists in Petra. So that's all I knew. But I had a story that for many, many years I'd wanted to tell. I didn't think that I was going to write about it, but that's what I ended up doing. And it's a story that's found in, they're called the Synoptic Gospels. They're the three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that are found in the New Testament. Well, there's a story that shows up in all three of those that only takes place over about a 1 or 2 hour period. But that story of a man who is beset by demons on the eastern shore of Lake Galilee, and he was delivered by demons, from demons by Jesus. Well, that story has stuck in my mind for a long time. I don't know exactly why, but it did. And I always thought, you know, there's more of a story to be told here. And what much of historical fiction is that people look into some part of history that just deeply fascinates them, and they know there's something more to be said. For the most part, let's say there's a historical fiction novel that's been written. It has a lot of dialogue in it, but most of that dialogue is not from recorded tapes or anything like that, or even scribbled notes of a conversation. They're conversations, dialogue that's totally generated by the author steeping themselves as much as they can in all the little minutiae of the history that is known. And they just let their creative juices flow and try to, as much as they can, construct what may have happened. So it is fiction. It's historical fiction. And, you know, there's a whole spectrum of fiction that goes from fiction that is virtually totally fiction. It's just set in a particular era and place. So it maybe has some of the trappings of the same culture, but that's it. Then it goes all the way to the other end of the spectrum where a lot is really known. And this is usually more contemporary historical fiction, like of the 20th century. There you can know much more about it, so you can really get more detail. Maybe you can even draw upon some recorded conversations. So in my case, I not only looked at the Synoptic Gospels and really tried to, as much as I could, take that little bit of recorded history and embed that in mine, but also look at the surrounding history, the culture of Judea, the culture of Nabatea, because this occurred east of Lake Galilee and east of the Jordan. That would have been, for the most part, Nabatea. So I thought, well, maybe this guy was a Nabatean. So at that point, since I didn't know anything about Nabatea, I had to start looking into it. And I went on to, there's a website called academia.edu. You can easily get a membership to it. It doesn't cost you anything. It is a wealth of scholarly articles and reports and all sorts of things, studies. And for history buffs, archaeologists, that is one of the huge places to go. So I just started devouring as much history as I could find. One of the strange things about the Nabatean kingdom, unlike most kingdoms and nations at that time, is that they did not leave any written records. They left basically zero archives. They were pretty much an oral culture, so they passed everything down orally, and they thought that was enough. In fact, there's some reason to believe that part of the reason they didn't record things is because they were kind of a secretive people. They really came out of nowhere. Nobody really knows what their origin is. And there are, well, maybe three or four historians at that time that made some guesses, but that's all they were. And they were nomads out in the desert wandering, had no resources, no wealth to speak of, were a bunch of camel and goat and sheep herders, and they managed to work that into the place of being probably an economic powerhouse that was maybe even greater economic power than actually the Empire of Rome at that time. Rome had much more military and political power, but I don't think they had quite as much economic power. And in fact, this is kind of an interesting thing. There's were Roman senators at that time that wrote articles that were very much like articles you would read today about people in the United States saying, all of our wealth is going to China. The trade imbalance that we have in China is really horrible. All our money is going over there because we're buying all that they have. And the Roman senators were saying the same thing about Nabatea. They were saying, all of our money is going to buy all these luxury goods from Nabatea, silk and gems and gold, and probably one of the biggest things was incense. In particular, what we call frankincense. They didn't produce any of these items, but they found out how to be middlemen and great merchants. They figured out how to find the sources of these things that were secret to the rest of the world, and they kept those things secret. They concocted all kinds of wild myths and stories to mislead people as to where they actually got this stuff. So I think some people believe that their secretive nature was part of what drove them not to keep any written records.
No, that makes sense. And I mean, you mentioned, and I think that's kind of good for people who've never heard of this to kind of know where it's at, because I talk to a lot of travelers, and there's a lot of people that are travelers that listen to this podcast, and people know Petra. You know, an Instagram worthy place for sure. So my question to that is, you know, were they in that area, or was it the Nabateans that, you know, built Petra? Are they the ones that built these, you know, these, for people who don't know, you know, it's, it's buildings within the rocks. You know, it's these correct. These really big, cool, you know, structures that are built within actual rocks. So they're the ones that built this?
Correct. Correct.
Yeah.
And people go to Petra today to see those sites in particular. And I've not yet been. I hope to go in the next year or so. And even what you see today, even in their ruined state, is quite remarkable. But it's actually nothing like the original city was. The original city, like today, when you look at them, they're pretty well eroded. You can tell what they were by looking at them. You can see much of the structure, but it's all the naked red sandstone that the things were carved out of. As you said, they were carved out of like cliffs, you know, a solid piece of rock, a mountain basically, and you're just taking chisel and hammer and you're carving into that thing. They started at the top and worked their way down in order to build these things. So now you see them as this naked red sandstone. And the sandstone is beautiful. But back then, they were all smoothly plastered and then painted with very bright bands of color, like white and yellow and maroon and things of that sort, deep blue. So all of these things were brightly colored. But even then, that wasn't really the remarkable part of Petra. In order to get there, you had to travel through hundreds and hundreds of miles of desert on the back of a camel. So you had to be pretty serious about going there. Generally, it was either political people going there to, like people from Rome, because they were kind of client states of Rome, since Rome had the political and military might. So you had to play nice with Rome. So there would be Roman people who would go there for that reason. Then also people from all over the Mediterranean would go there to make business deals with them. So you'd be on the back of a camel, trudging through the desert for weeks on end, going from caravanserai to caravanserai, from oasis to oasis. Finally, you go through this narrow little cleft in the rock. It's like 200 to 300 feet tall, the cleft, and anywhere between 8 and 12 feet wide. So it's a really like a slot canyon. I don't know if you or any of your audience has ever seen pictures of the Antelope Canyon out in the Southwest, but it's that sort of deal where you can almost reach out and touch the walls. So they're going through this little narrow passage from nothing but desert, and then they arrive in the middle of Petra, which is filled with public gardens, lush gardens, pools, things called nymphaeums, which are elaborate fountains. Kind of like if you go to Rome today and see all the great fountains, that's kind of what a nymphaeum was like. And then there was one large pool that was basically a swimming pool. That wasn't really open to the public. It was really for the royal family and the well-to-do. But there was a huge garden, botanical gardens, attached to that large pool. Had a big island pavilion in the middle of it. And then pouring into it was a man-made waterfall. This is out in the middle of the desert, which gets like 1 to 3 inches of rainfall a year. And that, to me, is the most remarkable thing of the Nabataeans. They had great economic might, all of these great trade deals and this and that, but their ability to do hydraulic engineering in a place that has almost no water resources is just next to miraculous. They had hundreds of 500 to 600 cisterns and water catchment reservoirs scattered all over Petra. And then they also did a lot of agriculture as well, where they harvested water in the same way. The little tiny bit of rainfall that would fall, they channeled off into underground carved out reservoirs.
I mean, I just wonder, we've already talked probably about the answer, and it's because, you know, the written records weren't there. They were secretive people. But I just wonder why you think that is the reason that most people haven't heard of this. You know, it makes sense, the whole written record things, but I had someone on about a year ago, probably, that, you know, talked all about Atlantis and finding that, and people, you know, right. Most people say that's not even real. So of course there's not factual written records there. So why do you think most people haven't heard of you know, this area?
I don't really know, other than, you know, it's out in the desert. It's at kind of a remote location. But as the world becomes more and more populated, and in particular in the Middle East, a lot of the Middle East countries, for instance, Jordan over the last 10 years has really upped their game as far as tourism. Jordan is really a poor country. They don't have like the oil reserves to fall back on that has made Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and United Arab Emirates, you know, places like that really flourish. They've attracted a lot of commerce as well as tourism, just because of the incredible things they've built due to their oil reserves. But Jordan is really a pretty poor country. So they finally have gotten on board with, you know, with all the international tourism that has just really accelerated over the last 10 years. They've really started to catch on to that, and they're trying to make their way to figure out how do we best present this to the world. So I think they're starting to do that. There's Nabataean presence all over Jordan. Jordan basically is most of what Nabatea was. If you think of taking present-day Jordan and northwestern Saudi Arabia, that's where Nabatea was. So they're also trying to figure out how best to manage that resource. All of a sudden, they, starting about, I think, 5 years ago, they started getting on the order of 1 million visitors a year. That's an incredible amount for a little, you know, one little place. And because Petra is constructed totally out of soft sandstone, the toll of tourists has really been heavy on the place. So now they're trying to figure out how best to manage that and not destroy it at the same time.
Yeah, that's kind of the age old issue when it comes to tourism, to historic sites, to preserve it, but make sure that you continue to bring in that economic benefit. So
right.
Yeah,
right.
I hear that for sure. So I want to actually get to, finally, I want to get to the book, and that is The Stonecutter. It is, you know, about Nabatea, but it's told in the way, just like you said, of historical fiction, where you've kind of created a scenario to teach everyone about kind of this world. So tell us, you know, what are people getting into when they crack open the book?
It's a story about a young man who starts his life basically as an orphan in Petra due to some family secrets, I guess you'd call them. He had been implicated in the tragic deaths of his younger sister and his mother as well. And due to that fact, his father abandons him in Petra. So he is brought up under the tutelage of a master sculptor in Petra. And he's kind of on the fast track to become a master sculptor himself. And pretty rapidly, as he's just about to rise to fame, his career is cut short for a couple of different reasons that I won't go into. I don't want to give any plot spoilers here.
Yeah.
But he finds himself on a quest looking for a mythical object called the Shamir. And this isn't something I dreamed up. It's actually a mythical device that is known mostly in ancient Jewish culture, but also other cultures as well have kind of picked up on it. And it's said to be this little item. People can't really come to a conclusion whether it's animal or mineral, but it's said to be able to carve or cut rock at its mere glance. So he thinks he can take this device and really become a world-known sculptor again. So he travels to the far ends of the earth looking for this device. And he gets into all kinds of hot water in the middle of it. So it's really the story of his life, his quest, his beginning rise to fame and tragic drop, and then ultimately finds out who he is.
So how did you, you know, find that delicate balance of teaching people kind of about this world and you know, the culture that people didn't know too much about, while also making it an enjoyable story and not just read like a textbook? You know, you talked about how, you know, you've got a lot of background in, you know, scientific research writing that could lend itself well to a very dry, boring book. So how did you make sure that didn't happen?
Well, that is kind of an interesting thing. You would think with my 50-year background in science and engineering that my mind would be 100% analytical and not really prone to creative pursuits. But in the research world, working in a laboratory, doing things that have never been done before, it really is very much a creative pursuit. And from day to day, you never really know what you're going to find when you go into the lab. You may think you know, but when you get there and start doing some things, you find out that you didn't have a clue as to what was really going to go on. So that in itself really lends it to really the more creative aspects of your brain. So for a long time, I've kind of been in that mold. But my writing certainly was dry, boring, technical reports at that time. But when I started writing fiction, to me, it is very much a different sort of thing. Because my method of doing it, I don't know if you or your audience has ever heard this, but authors generally divide themselves into two camps. They say there's outliners and there's pantsers. People who think of a plot, they start outlining it, they figure out all the details and how all the pieces and parts fit together. And then there are people who write by the seat of their pants. Mm-hmm. And they just start at the beginning and they have no clue where they're going and they just let it fly. And that's really more my mode of doing it. When I very first started writing, that was much the way it was. I didn't even have a clue the next day at all what I was going to be writing. It just basically came to me in the sort of a video on the screen of my mind as I lay in bed awake at 4 o'clock in the morning. And then at that time, I was still working. I hadn't retired yet from my day job. Then I would come home from work the next evening and I'd feverishly try and type it out as fast as I could while it was still fresh in my mind. So there was no analyzing or outlining or anything of that sort. In the book that I published, The Stonecutter, it wasn't quite that much, but it was, for the most part, just let it fly. So I'm very much a pantser type writer. And the way I normally do it is just to fill myself as much as I can with the stuff that I think that is going to pop up somewhere in the writing. And it always has. For instance, right now I'm writing a short story that will, maybe in a month, will be what authors call a reader magnet on my website, where you can go and sign up for my newsletter. And as your payment for signing up for my newsletter, you get a free short story in the deal. So I already have one there for that purpose, but I'm writing a new one right now. Well, the story is going to be about a boy who becomes a falconer. Falconry is a huge part of Arab culture, and was Nabataean culture. At the time, the Nabataeans called themselves the Nabatu. We call them the Nabataeans. But at the time, the Western part of that world, the Mediterranean world, the Greeks, the Romans, they all called them Arabs. That's where the term Arab came from that we use today. So really, the Nabataeans were Arabs. So this boy is going to become a falconer. And I didn't know anything about falconry, so I found some great resources about falconry written from an Arab perspective. They've been apparently been doing falconry for something like 3,000 or 4,000 years. So it's a rich part of their culture and is today. So I've as I'm reading this book about falconry, it's opened up all kinds of possibilities for this story. And though I'm not really directly writing pieces of that story as I read the book, as I begin writing the short story itself, it'll reveal itself and all that stuff will start popping out.
No, I love that. We'll have to anxiously await that for sure. But I want to ask you, you know, we talked about Henry and his 10-year quest to write his book. How long did it take you to write The Stonecutter?
The first book that I wrote, the first novel, which my wife still desperately wants me to publish, I wrote in 6 months while I was holding down a 40-hour-a-week research job. It's a 128,000-word novel. So that would be about somewhere between 450 and maybe 480 pages. So that's a pretty considerable work in, you know, a part-time pursuit. The Stonecutter took me longer than that. It took me probably more like a year and a half to 2 years. And I'm writing the second novel of the series, which I'd hoped to write within about a year, but I had some things going on in my life earlier in the year that kind of made that take second place. So it's kind of delayed it a little bit, but I still hope to be able to launch it sometime yet this year.
Yeah. Well, you've already kind of answered an important question. That is, you know, you just talked about getting married and you're a relatively newlywed. And then you went into this pursuit of writing, which takes up a lot of time. Sometimes, you know, that doesn't always bode well in relationships when you've got a relationship with your, you know, with your writing as well. But it sounds like your wife is very supportive and she wants you to come, you know, write, or she wants you to publish that first book. So I guess my question to you there is, you've written this 400 pages. What's making you not publish it?
I guess because the book that I published is really the story that had been on my heart for many, many years. So I really wanted to get that published. And then as I wrote it, part of the reason that I didn't go back to the first book, well, there's a couple of reasons. Most authors will tell a new author, never publish your first novel. Because generally, it's not a very good work. And we'll see where this first novel goes. That's been part of my hesitance. But she says, no, this is a really good book. You need to publish it. And a few other people have said that as well. So I will probably come back to it. But another reason is that I got so fascinated by the Nabataeans and all that I thought, I can't leave it at that. This has to be a series. We got to be talking more about Nabataea. So ultimately, I would like that to be a 7-book series, but we'll see if it really goes that far. But maybe I can come back to the other book maybe next year and kind of branch out, because this has nothing to do with Nabataea. It's set in the southeastern part of the United States just before and after the Civil War.
So are you, because we talked about how, you know, there's outliners and there's people that just write and see where it takes them every day. You know, I have talked to authors that talked about that before. And then there's another subset of authors outside of that, that also there's people who they write one book and they've got to stick with that one thing and they can't, you know, they can't venture off. And then there's people who need breaks and then they go write something else and then they come back. Are you somebody who, are you going to stick with that Nebitean world and get all seven books out?
I don't know. I originally committed myself to seven books and my wife keeps saying, don't tell them seven books. Don't tell them seven books. Maybe it'll be just three books or four books. So I don't know how much it will be. It's just that I had such a fascination with them that I wanted to write more. But I have a lot of interest. You know, I can look into almost anything. If you look into something deeply enough, you find out, for one, it's incredibly fascinating. I don't care what the subject is. If you look deep enough and talk to somebody that really knows about it, there is really fascinating stuff to be found there. Then on top of that, you find out the deeper you look into something, the more you know how much people don't know, which again lends itself to fiction. You know, you can really kind of go beyond what is known. So, you know, I can see myself, I've already thought there's probably 20 or 30 series that I could really write if I would live long enough. You know, I'm 73 now. My dad just passed earlier this year at the age of 102, and my mom passed at 98. So, and my wife told me when I married her at age 70, she said, you're going to give me 30 years, right? So who knows? Maybe I've got a career in this anyway.
Yeah, well, if nothing else, you've got books to write, so you can't leave anybody hanging, right?
There you go.
So did you say that first book was set in the Southeast or Southwest?
Southeast. And this book is not told, it's not a man who's a protagonist, it's a woman. And that's quite a story in itself, how that book got written, even though I was never going to write a novel. I was pushed and shoved into that. But that's for a later time for us to talk.
For sure. Well, I was thinking, if you said Southwest, you really are hitting an area that nobody knows a ton about, with, you know, in the Civil War days. So
this was in Northwest Georgia.
I gotcha. Well, we're teasing that, and it may never leave your drawer. So we gotta move on from that for sure. But I guess you kind of tasked yourself when it comes to writing these books with teaching people about this world and also trying to entertain them. So what do you hope that people gain from reading the book? What do you want them to walk away with?
I think one thing is that regardless of how dire your circumstances might look at any point in time, there's always some possibility embedded in that seeming impossibility. I think that's one thing. I guess the old saw is, there's a silver lining to every cloud, something like that, because that's really what's going on in this young man's life. He goes through all sorts of horrific things beyond which any of us can imagine, and ends up coming out on the other side in a good place. So I guess that's one thing. Another thing is just how much there is to know about the world that is unknown, that is unexplored. The Nabataeans, as you mentioned several times, most people don't really hardly know anything about it. They may not even have heard that term, Nabatea, before. So I think it's to open up people's eyes that there are large things going on, either in the past or currently, that maybe you never heard of, that really may be pretty remarkable things to look into, to explore, to be fascinated by. So I think those are some of the things that I'd like people to find out.
No, I think those are really awesome things for sure. So we've got to ask, you know, whether you're you're going to take us to the Southeast United States, or you're going to take us to the Middle East next time. There's more in store. So what, how can people follow along with you? How can they make sure? You already mentioned a newsletter, but how can they pick up the book? How can they sign up for your newsletter? Just shout out all your connection points, if you will.
Okay. First of all, you can find out pretty much anything you want to know about the book, about me as an author, by going to my website, which is very simple. It's brockmeierauthor.com. B-R-O-C-K-M-E-I-E-R, author.com. No dashes, no spaces, just all one word. And there you'll find more detailed information about the book itself. I have a lot of resources that I just recently added you can find out more about Nabatea, about the series of books. You can read more about me becoming an author. I also have a web channel, which is YouTube /@ Brockmeier Author, the same basic words. And right now I have there, I think I've got about 8 or 9 audio interviews that I've done with my characters in The Stonecutter. So you might find that interesting. I think people that have read the book would find them interesting because they already know something about the characters, but these delve a little bit more into the characters, who they are, how they think, what makes them tick. And for people that haven't read the book, you can explore those as well, and maybe that'll pique your interest a little bit about finding the book. The book, The Stonecutter, you can find on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, pretty much anywhere books are sold. If it's not on the shelf of your local bookseller, they can order it. I haven't got it up yet, but I hope soon to have the possibility on my website of ordering directly from me, which means that I can send you a signed copy. And I also make a lot better profit. Even though you would buy it for cheaper, you can make a lot more I can make a lot more profit than I can off of Amazon. So often people like to support authors in that way.
Yeah.
No, so pretty much my website, YouTube channel is where I mainly hang out.
Yeah. And all of that will be in the show notes for sure. I really, really appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks for having me. Enjoyed speaking with you and connecting with your audience.
So that was Brockmeier. This is one that if you didn't learn a lot, then you are smarter than most, because, you know, I fancy myself as somebody who knows quite a bit about history, but I knew nothing about Nabatea. I knew Petra, you know, I knew about it in Jordan. It's somewhere that I would love to visit, but I had no idea who created it. And I definitely didn't know that there was this huge civilization that had created so much back in their time that people just know nothing about. They just don't know the name of it. So if you knew about it, then more power to you. Hopefully we were still able to teach you something. But if you didn't, I hope you found that interesting. Just an entire different civilization, almost as big as the Roman civilization at one point. But they just didn't carry as long into history because of the way that they recorded their history. And it was all oral rather than written down. So yeah, I really enjoyed speaking with Brock. I enjoyed listening to the world of Nabatea and his books, but I also really enjoyed learning about, you know, his career in science and his, even up to his current, I guess, relationship and finding his match online. I thought that was interesting too. But yeah, he's a great guy. We spoke for a while, even after the recording stopped, talking about some of his travels. And yeah, it was really, really amazing. So urge you to check out his books. I know more are coming. He has some that are just sitting in the drawers. Maybe he'll get those out. I know that his wife wants him to, but he definitely has some more books coming in the world of Nabatea too. Follow along with him. All the links to him will be in the show notes. Follow along with this podcast, Not in the Huff, with Jackson Huff on Facebook, Not in the Huff Podcast on Instagram and on TikTok. Go leave a 5-star review on Apple and on Spotify. Appreciate that very much. Leave a written review on Apple, helps even more. But if you do nothing else, catch us next week. Take it away, Chris.
This has been Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff. Thank you for listening. Be sure to join us next time, where we will interview another amazing guest who is sure to make you laugh or make you think, or hey, maybe even both. But until then, keep being awesome.